Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Robert Akers, appellant versus Casper Lodging, appellee. And for the appellant, we have Mr. Mitchell Peterson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Terry Hofer and Mr. Gregory Erlandson, attorneys from Rapid City. I understand, Mr. Erlandson, you'll be presenting this morning?
That's correct.
Very well. Justice Wilbur has issues with allergies, and so she will listen to the argument and obviously participate fully with the justices, but it's not fun to sit up here with allergies. So anyway, she'll be participating. And with that, Mr. Peterson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. Casper Lodging allowed water to regularly penetrate its hotel for years. Casper made cosmetic repairs and ignored water saturating the structural components of the hotel through water leaking through uncaulked windows. Casper failed to pursue its warranty rights against contractors. It ignored its own experts' recommendations to make immediate repairs for 3 years, and they neglected to notify Bob Akers that there was any water issue at the hotel for several years. This water problem festered into what became nearly a $1 million repair situation. Casper has failed to establish any term of the sale contract that was actually breached, as Bob Akers made no promises regarding the quality or defect-free nature of the construction and provided no warranties himself. Rather, warranties against the contractors were assigned to Casper. The jury awarded every penny, including the consulting fees, for the same expert opinion that they ignored for 3 years. The court then awarded $1 million in prejudgment interest, including for the 6-year period of time during which Casper let this problem fester and spent no money and no loss of use of the hotel. Casper received a complete renovation of a 6-year-old hotel, $500,000 in prejudgment interest, while expending no money and having no loss of use. And this was accomplished primarily in 5 ways. Number 1, erroneous jury instructions. Number 2, improper exclusion of Bob Akers' expert damages opinions, which were offered to rebut newly disclosed evidence and new expert opinions. Number 3, ambushing Akers at trial through undisclosed expert opinions introduced through misleading characterization to the trial court about what was actually disclosed. Number 4, improper closing arguments suggesting that Bob Akers was to blame for Casper's non-disclosure of evidence. And number 5, improper closing arguments that Akers had collateral sources against whom he had remedies to pursue. Bob Akers is entitled to judgment as a matter of law for several reasons. Alternatively, this court should grant a new fair trial with proper jury instructions. We have approximately 17 appeal issues, so I'll start getting to them, but if there are particular issues that are of more interest, I'm prepared to go wherever the court would like to go this morning. On the issue of judgment as a matter of law, the first issue that we've raised is the proper measure of damages. This case involves damage to property, water damage primarily to the hotel and some other related repair expenses. Casper failed to introduce any evidence of diminished or diminution of market value of the hotel.
Is that Casper's burden? And if so, what case law authority would you rely on for that proposition?
We cited, I believe, there's an Iowa case that deals with this, that a party's failure to produce evidence on one of the two factors in a measure of damages is a failure of that party's burden to meet its prima facie burden of giving that evidence to the jury to make that comparison. I don't believe this court has decided that particular issue. I don't think it has happened to come up in our case law. But there's an Iowa case cited in our brief that deals with that particular issue, and the court there held that it is the plaintiff's burden to establish evidence on all of the elements of its claim. This court has repeatedly held in all contexts that when property damage is involved, the proper measure of damages is diminished market value or repair costs, whichever is less. It was, this court held that in the Ward case dealing with water damage, it was a negligence claim. In the Rupert case dealing with tree damage, the claim there was negligence, trespass, and inverse condemnation. In the Subserfco case involving construction defects and a construction contract, and also in the Reed case where there was a cave-in in a mine and it had to do with responsibility under a mining lease or contract. The point of it is to avoid economic waste, that if a party has a fairly modest diminished market value and an exceptionally high repair cost, they don't get the windfall. The jury has to award the lesser of the two. So it avoids economic waste. That's the policy reason behind it. And it's no less of an important policy factor in a sale of a building. This court has never distinguished between the type of claim being made. The dispositive factor is what is the nature of the damage. And the nature of the damage in this case is property damage. The particular claim is breach of contract.
Certainly in Rupert, the defense brought in the diminution in value as an alternative measure of damages. And so your argument here is that there's an Iowa case that says that it's the obligation of the plaintiff to bring in both measures of damage and not the obligation of the defense to bring in an alternative measure of damages for the jury's consideration?
Yes, that is the prima facie burden. And then the defense can attack both or either or none. There may be a disagreement on what is the diminished market value and what is the appropriate repair cost, but it is initially the plaintiff's burden to present that evidence for the jury to consider.
What about the language in our cases that suggests that it's not relevant if the property can be reasonably repaired?
I believe the standard is that if a property can be restored through repair, then that's the proper measure of damage. And that is...
Isn't that what happened here?
That is what happened. The property was, in fact, restored. So I don't think there's any dispute on the record about that. It was restored, which means that lesser of measure of damage is what would be applicable. If the plaintiff chooses to repair, even if there's a modest market value loss, that's the plaintiff's choice, but they don't get compensated for that. They get compensated for the diminished market value. We believe that the trial court in this case abused its discretion in denying judgment as a matter of law, and we'd request relief in the form of reversal on that. Alternatively, the trial court rejected our proposed jury instruction, which called for that measure of damage being the lesser of the repair cost or the diminished market value. Alternatively, we should have a retrial with the correct jury instruction on the measure of damage. And that was our jury instruction number 45. On the issue of judgment as a matter of law for lack of breach of contract, what's important to look at here, and certainly with limited time, we can't go through every single term of the contract, but in Section 2 of the IPA, or the Improvement Purchase Agreement, it sets the terms and conditions under which Akers was selling the hotel to Casper. And it describes simply what is being sold. And there's one reference in there that what is being sold is a turnkey hotel. And in Casper's brief, they repeatedly say, we didn't get a turnkey hotel. We got a hotel with a lot of problems. The trial court specifically found that Casper waived its right to get a turnkey hotel because they bought it before construction was complete. That wasn't appealed. There was no notice of review on that issue. So that is the law of the case. It was not appealed by Casper. So that particular part of the contract cannot form the basis for breach of contract.
Well, if it's not a turnkey, though, does that go all the way to the other side and say you're stuck with whatever you've got, including water coming in everywhere?
What's important, yes, that is. I mean, all contracts allocate risk. If you get a new car that's 3 years, 36,000-mile warranty, the risk of the motor blowing up is on Ford or Chevy for the first 36 miles. The risk of it blowing up after 36,000 miles is on the buyer. Contracts allocate risk. This contract, which was negotiated over months with counsel, allocates risk. And the risk of construction defects is on Casper Lodging. That's why warranties were transferred and assigned to Casper Lodging. So if anything's wrong with the building, it's Casper's obligation to go to the contractor or the particular subcontractor or trade that dealt with the particular issue. Casper had, there are a number of conditions precedent in Section 7 of the contract that needed to be satisfied or waived by Casper before Casper became obligated to purchase the building. All those conditions were either met or waived. The record supports that. Our brief identifies the different places in the record where all those conditions were either met or waived. The only obligation that Bob Akers had was to sell the hotel, which he did. And the only other section of the contract that talks about Bob Akers' obligations is Section 11 under the seller's representations. Bob Akers had to transfer warranties, which he did. Bob Akers had to cooperate with transitioning the hotel to operation, which there's never been any argument as to that. And the final obligation was to cooperate with Casper on the timing of a 1031 exchange, which, again, that wasn't an issue. Bob Akers sold this hotel. He wasn't the contractor. He didn't build it. There's no implied warranty in commercial construction when you've got a seller who's not the builder. The contract allocated the risk of construction defects to Casper. There's no dispute this building had problems. Nobody disputes that. But that's not a breach of contract if the court, under a de novo review, examines the contract.
Can you move to the issue involving the expert Trent Nelson and the allegedly undisclosed expert opinion?
Yes, Your Honor.
The limiting instruction and so on.
And I think this is the biggest mistrial issue by far. I think it's the most significant. Before trial, the expert disclosure stated that Trent Nelson would testify that the building was structurally unsound because of long-term water damage. And part of that opinion in his deposition, he stated that there's a problem with the fastening, because not with the number of fasteners and not an inadequate number of nails, but because this OSB, the wood right behind the stucco, was waterlogged and soaked and breaking apart from water damage, there's nothing to fasten there. So that was his opinion, that because of long-term water damage, it was structurally unsound. At trial, his opinion changed significantly. He testified that there was an inadequate number of nails in the OSB board in the original construction, and that the building was unsound, unsafe, a nuisance, and a code violation from day one, regardless of water damage.
Was he asked why he changed his opinion?
He was.
What was his answer?
He changed his opinion based on information that he heard at trial from the very first trial witness. Without even really having to paint Mr. Nelson in a corner, he readily admitted these were entirely new opinions, contrary to what Casper's counsel represented.
But how is he supposed to predict the future at deposition by what other witnesses are going to say at trial?
Well, I mean, that's the nature of an expert disclosure. I mean, he's...
Disclose what? He doesn't know what those witnesses are going to testify at trial yet.
Well, there is evidence in the record in one of the invoices that there were five boxes of nails purchased, and that is the evidence that he also heard at trial from a witness talking about the five boxes of nails, because there's 5,000 nails per box. So that would have been available to him prior to that. Additionally, Ryan Pace was Casper's witness, and the issue is the trial court was misled here. Was absolutely misled. And Trent Nelson, Casper's counsel stated that after reading the deposition that there's a fastening issue because of the wet condition of the OSB, then stated, he talks about fastening pattern, Your Honor, that means nailing. And we then made very clear to the court that Mr. Nelson didn't say in his deposition, two of them, or report at any point that the OSB as originally constructed was improperly fastened. His opinion is that it was too moist and that was the structural problem. The trial court at that point in time didn't appreciate this important distinction and said he's got a problem with the fastening pattern. To me, it's a nail is a fastener, that's it. It was a very cursory review and cursory analysis. And when Nelson was then cross-examined, he readily admitted, yeah, this is entirely new. I've never talked about this before. I came up with this opinion this week at trial. And the trial court then said, I'm a little disturbed, Mr. Erlandson, that That part you read from your deposition, your witness departed from that to come here with an entirely new opinion. That is disturbing to me. The trial court was given an improper and misleading characterization of the true nature of the disclosure. And trial court judges are not in a position to read two deposition transcripts in order to know what exactly was disclosed. The trial court has got to rely on counsel to be straight with the trial court. And if this court allows this to be permitted, I think it sends the wrong message to the trial bar to try to get away with what you can and to get a curative instruction later. I think that's bad policy. And this is particularly important because our primary defense was Casper failed to mitigate. They let water leak through these windows for 6 years, and they painted over it. And they didn't ever say, wow, water's coming through the windows. It's ruining our structural components. They let it fester. Trent Nelson's opinion that this building was unsafe from day one, regardless of water, absolutely gutted our mitigation defense. It was absolutely immune to the entirety of what we wanted to do at trial. And the jury can't unhear that. He went on for approximately 10 pages on this topic. He went on for dozens of more pages while Mr. Erlandson covered other questions with him. The jury had significant time for that to sink in before any sort of curative instruction was given. And I don't think Akers ought to be punished for trying to make the best out of a bad situation. If there's no curative instruction, I believe Kaiser, Papke, and Young Viore all make clear that we're entitled to a new trial because of this lack of disclosure. And this court has ordered a mistrial when an expert simply used some undisclosed photographs to bolster an opinion that was otherwise disclosed. And this court found a mistrial in Young Viore when a witness was simply allowed to use a demonstrative exhibit to illustrate what he wanted to talk about that was later determined it wasn't fairly disclosed and there wasn't proper foundation. Here we've got an expert opinion that goes to the heart of our defense, absolutely guts it. The jury hears about it for 10 minutes. Here's it's a code violation, a nuisance, a risk of blowing over in the wind. How are they supposed to hear that? How are they supposed to listen to Bob Akers' defense for the next week and a half about Casper letting water leak through the building when they've already heard all these repairs needed to be done anyway? This thing was a structural problem and a code violation from day one. I think it sends the wrong message to the trial bar, and I think we're entitled to a new trial and a fair trial. The curative instruction was simply not enough to, as this court has put it, fully overcome the prejudice. That might have overcome, sort of, it's fully overcome the prejudice. That's the language used in Young v. Ori. Further complicating this case is the exclusion of our expert and his damages opinions. Casper Lodging was a moving target on their damages. They dumped invoices and bills of lading and all sorts of documents without any explanation of what are you claiming and what are you not claiming. What Casper actually put forth as what they were claiming as expenses, that was disclosed after our expert disclosure deadline and after our expert, Mr. Potter, was deposed. That's when it was first given to us. And then at trial, they presented this evidence. They presented testimony from their expert talking about what work was done. And we offered Mr. Potter's opinions to rebut that new evidence that came after he was deposed and after the expert disclosure. I think fairness requires a chance to rebut that new information.
But Potter didn't give any opinion at all in his deposition, did he, about what Casper's damages actually were?
Mr. Potter testified that he would be addressing damages. Again, nothing had come. He said in his deposition he's not able to talk about any dollars because, fairly, he can't talk about something he's never seen.
Well, he didn't have. You're telling me that he didn't have any information about Casper's damages at the time of his deposition? Not the Rule 1006 summary, but are you saying that he had no information about Casper's damages at the time of the deposition?
No, I'm not saying that. What we had receipts and bills and records of every penny Casper had spent in this hotel, related and unrelated. What we didn't know is what are they claiming is part of the claim and what is not. I mean, there's one of the trial binders, I believe is a couple inches thick, of expenses that are not being claimed as part of the lawsuit. So, you know, Mr. Potter could have been asked by Casper's counsel, you know, are there particular things that didn't need to be done, or here's our damages, are you claiming this didn't need to be done? He could have been asked more questions. We could have been given more complete information. And additionally, when I deposed Wendell Potratz, their damages expert, and I asked him, you know, what are the damages that are being claimed? He had only seen the damages summary the day prior, and he couldn't answer any specific questions on it. Now, at trial, he got pretty well informed in the couple of months between his deposition and trial, and he was able to answer all those questions. We just wanted an opportunity to rebut that information and rebut those opinions. We think fairness requires that. Nelson and Potter are big issues that warrant a new trial in this case. You know, there are a number of issues that are in our brief. Certainly, we're not going to be able to get to all of those today, but there are a number of errors in this case in terms of jury instructions. The jury had a lot of evidence on warranty rights and zero jury instruction on what that meant. No instruction on the importance of the warranty instruction. And then counsel in closing argument said Akers has his own remedies to pursue the subcontractors. I think that was an improper statement that was highlighted and magnified by the lack of instruction on warranties.
Your time has expired, Mr. Peterson. Thank you. Mr. Erlandson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, I'm here on behalf of Casper Lodging. What I'd like to do today is tell you why the court was correct and why the jury verdict was correct as well, address a few of the misstatements and myths that are contained in Mr. Akers' position. But I want to first start out with one of the very first rules of civil procedure that I learned. Professor Barron started out with rule number one, and that is that the rules of civil procedure are to be construed to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. In this case, litigation and the two-week trial was just. Judge Eklund, after reviewing all of the evidence, all of the pleadings, sitting through that two-week trial, said both parties got a fair trial. Now, while the determination of the action was just, it was neither speedy nor inexpensive. This litigation involved over 4 years, 20 attorneys, 18 parties, 30 depositions, 2 rounds of discovery, over 300 pleadings, 2 judges, and 3 different trial dates. The jury found in this case that Mr. Akers breached a very simple contract, a contract that required him to sell an improvement. And that improvement was defined in the contract as a Holiday Inn Express that would meet certain standards. That improvement, in the very purpose of that improvement purchase agreement, defines what the improvement is. The improvement is going to be a hotel constructed in accordance with plans and specifications prepared by Mr. Akers. There's nearly 2,000 pages of trial testimony and motions testimony that indicates that that hotel was not delivered anywhere close to that standard. The jury found that Akers didn't fulfill his promise. Now, Mr. Keeler did, and if you'd believe Casper's or Mr. Akers' position on this issue, the only duty that Mr. Akers had was to take nearly $5 million from my client. The jury didn't buy that, and neither should this court. The jury found that Mr. Akers didn't fulfill his promise, and in reality, rather than delivering a hotel that met the quality standards set forth in the contract, really delivered a lemon with $1 million repair bill. If you accept Akers' position in this case, you have to throw out the plain language of this contract. You have to disregard the 2 weeks of trial testimony that was presented on numerous issues on both sides of those issues. You have to substitute your judgment for that of the jury's, and you have to make new law.
All right, Mr. Erlandson, what part of the contract are you saying was breached? What language in the contract?
There are several parts, Your Honor. In the improvement purchase agreement, it talks about the purpose of the agreement. The purpose of the agreement is to sell an improvement. The improvement is defined. My client didn't get the improvement. The improvement is defined in here by saying said improvements are being constructed or built pursuant to the plans and specifications. Mr. Akers' position on this contract does violence not only to the language of the contract, but also to common sense. Nobody in their right mind, especially sophisticated business people, is going to pay nearly $5 million to a half-constructed hotel, or to somebody for a half-constructed hotel, without having some assurances that the hotel is going to be built to a certain standard. Mr. Akers likes to characterize the rights that my client might have had to take a look or inspect the hotel during its construction as some sort of a duty or an obligation to do so, which would somehow release him from his obligation to construct it.
That's well and good, but you're saying that the breach is in that introductory language? Is it? You said there's several places,
yes.
But all you said was an introductory language. Right. That's it?
No, I'm sorry. I meant to get to the addendum to the contract. That was something that was actually omitted from Mr. Akers' brief. The court didn't receive the full contract in their brief, and I'd like to refer to the addendum, which specifically incorporates
the original.
But
you haven't submitted that to us either?
It is, Your Honor. It was actually trial exhibit number one.
Okay.
That's a correct copy, a full copy of the contract. The addendum specifically reaffirms the purpose of the contract and the requirements of the contract to build it to a certain quality standard by saying, on the very first page, the seller shall have the continuing obligation to construct and finish the improvements in accordance with all governmental requirements and the standards and specifications of the Holiday Inn Express system. So, in a sense, there's three different spots that tell us what the standards are.
All right. Now, Holiday Inn accepted it, correct?
They did, Your Honor.
And so what specifically are you saying are standards that weren't met? I assume you're saying government standards weren't met.
Right.
What specifically are you saying wasn't met?
Well, there were, over the course of that two-week trial, Your Honor, there were numerous items of that those standards were not met. The plans and specifications themselves incorporate the building code. There was testimony on both sides of the issue that the building code was not met. That's part of the contract because the plans and specifications that were approved by my client said, you know what, we're going to follow the Uniform Building Code, so that provides me with a level of protection. The Holiday Inn Express, now this is important. Mr. Akers claims that because the Holiday Inn Express folks and the folks with the city of Casper approved, that somehow that relieves him of an obligation to cure, obligation for any of the previous defects. And that does no such thing. If you look at the contract simply says that on the date prior to closing, buyer will have obtained the approval from the Holiday Inn Express system that it complies with all system requirements and can be opened for business. There was a manual, a Holiday Inn Express manual about that thick, Your Honor. Holiday Inn didn't come back and check the Holiday Inn Express manual and the plans and specifications and guarantee that there were no problems or that it met every single one of those specifications. What I'd like to do in my short period of time that I have with you is address a few of the issues that are most troubling to me, personally and professionally. The first is the attacks on my candor and that of my counsel. You heard counsel here just tell you that I misled the trial court concerning the concerning the testimony of Mr. Nelson. I did no such thing. He told you just moments ago that I misrepresented the deposition testimony of Mr. Nelson in an effort to try and get the court to allow a new opinion in. The settled record, the transcript at page 555, I tell the court, before even proffering Mr. Nelson's testimony, I tell the court that the nail issue was a new issue that came up during trial. I specifically told the court that because I knew it was a new issue. I knew that while Mr. Nelson had talked about a fastening pattern before, he didn't talk about this issue of nailing. And so I told the court and let the court make a decision after reading verbatim Mr. Nelson's deposition testimony. Mr. Nelson's deposition or testimony and his opinions in this case didn't just involve nails, Your Honors. His testimony was from day one. There were numerous and substantial structural deficiencies with this building. His opinion on the nail was basically just new facts or data supporting his opinion that the OSB was structurally unsound. He learned that information during the course of the trial from Mr. Pace. And all of that information was fully disclosed to the court before the court made its decision to allow it. Now, once Mr. Nelson moved from the nails to making the conclusion that the failure to properly fasten was a violation of the code, that was a new opinion. And that's what the trial court was troubled or disturbed by, not by counsel's conduct concerning the representations. It had nothing to do with that. And the court, properly struck or not, did the right thing and gave a curative instruction immediately. None of those four factors that the court should find helpful help Mr. Akers in this case. First and foremost, the issue, there was no misconduct, and he has to allege misconduct in order to try and get over that hurdle. I also want to address the allegation that Mr. Hofer gave an improper closing argument by referencing Nelson's stricken testimony concerning the nails. They make that in their brief. That is untrue. Nowhere on that page cited, Mr. Akers cites to page 1746 of the trial transcript, nowhere on that page, nor anywhere else in that closing, does Mr. Hofer talk about nails or a nailing pattern. Mr. Akers also claims that Casper counsel committed error during closing argument by referencing that Mr. Akers has his own remedies against Sheet Metal, a subcontractor, and Zaco. That was not misconduct, Your Honor. That was fair comment on the evidence that was within the record already. The evidence in the record was actually at Exhibit 7 was the contract, a construction contract between Mr. Akers and his contractor, Zaco. That contract provides what Mr. Akers' remedies are if the general contractor and subcontractors screw up on the project. What Mr. Hofer talked about was merely a description of the relationship between the parties. Now I'd like to turn to the proper measure of damages. Justice Kern, I believe, pardon the pun, but he hit the nail right on the head with the burden issue. You asked Akers' counsel whether or not we have the burden or they should have the burden. In fact, one of the cases cited by Mr. Akers in this case, the Sanborn Electric case, deals specifically with that issue. That court said that the burden is on the breaching contractor or the builder to present evidence of unreasonable economic waste. And they cite Corbin on contracts for that proposition. That appears to be the majority rule as I've researched it. Makes sense from both a procedural and a practical reason to put the burden on the breaching party or the breaching builder. And that is, and it's set forth further in Sanborn, it says that the putting the burden on the non-breaching party, the owner, doesn't make sense because what the owner wants is simply the amount of money to make the repairs. And it doesn't make sense to require the non-breaching party to carry the burden of proof on an element that might be adverse to his cause. And before we even get to the issue of unreasonable economic waste, I think it's important that we focus on what we can agree upon. We agree that this is not a construction case. It's not a construction defect case. It's not a construction contract case. It was admitted by Mr. Akers at trial, and it was admitted in his briefing to this court. Well, what does that mean? That means we don't get to the unreasonable economic waste distinction because in every single case, Your Honor, in every single case that addresses the issue of unreasonable economic waste, you have to have a construction contract. The cases cited in Subsurfco, Northern Farm Supply, it defines, it tells us what a construction contract is. And this is not a construction contract. So that's the first element of how you get to unreasonable economic waste or the diminution in value instruction. The second part of that is whether or not there's unreasonable economic waste. There's no unreasonable economic waste. Unreasonable economic waste, in its simplest terms, is if in order to correct defects, you have to destroy a substantial portion of good work in order to correct that defect, then it's unreasonable economic waste. In Subsurfco, the unreasonable economic waste was fairly simple. It was the fact that there was, I believe, about 12 miles of pipe that was laid at an average depth of, I believe, 5 feet 2 or 5 feet 3 rather than 6 feet as required by the contract. The pipe was otherwise conforming and was performing. The question was, is it reasonable to require the removal of that good pipe and relaying it a couple inches lower in order to cure that contract defect? The court said, of course not. It doesn't make sense. So that's a very limited exception to the proposition that a breaching party or non-breaching party is not entitled to get the damages necessary to get him up to the level that the contract provided him. So I believe that it's clear that the Subsurfco case is non-applicable in this case. And even if we jump ahead a little bit, 25 years to the Gettysburg School District case, that case involved a construction contract between a builder and an owner.
Since you've mentioned Gettysburg, the trial court made a factual finding, in essence, that the date of loss was the date that the hotel was turned over, March 11 of 2004?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What loss occurred on the date of the breach?
And that was the subject to a great...
March 11.
On March 11th?
Yeah. What loss occurred on that day?
The loss on that day was that the contract specifications were not met, and in order to correct that contract between what he received and what he should have received on that day when he opened up that door, it would have cost $1 million.
But Casper hadn't spent a dime at that point.
Absolutely. That's correct. And that goes, again, to the Gettysburg case. The issue of whether the repairs are made at the time the project is turned over or if the repairs are made in the future, a year, 2, or 5 years down the road, does not make them future and impermissible damages. In this case, our expert testified on the day that he got that got the keys, it would have cost $1 million to get the building up to the contract standards. It would have cost $1 million to, for example, make sure that all of the windows were flashed correctly. I could spend hours talking about the evidence, the 2,000 pages of, or the 1,800 pages of trial transcript, but every single window in the place was installed incorrectly. The stucco was applied incorrectly. From roof to floor, wall to wall,
all right.
The place was riddled with defects.
You mentioned the damage as an expert. What about the exclusion of the defense's expert witness when he didn't have the information from you at the time of his deposition?
I would like to respectfully correct the premise of that question, and that is that we didn't give him the information necessary to make his opinions. He testified at trial.
That was the reason for the exclusion.
Well, the reason for his exclusion, it was an entirely new opinion, Your Honor. What happened was, just weeks before trial, Mr. Akers settled with all of the subcontractors. His position on damages initially was to push all of the damages off on Casper and say, you failed to mitigate, failed to turn in warranty claims, so therefore you would have no damages. He didn't challenge ever the line item damage amounts that we were claiming. Then, a couple years after the litigation started, they bring in 16 of the subcontractors, I believe, and said, you know what, we're not going to challenge Casper's damages. We're going to push all of those damages on the subcontractors, and that's what their position was all the way up until trial, until they settled with them. They didn't challenge those damages. And I think the most important fact to look at on the issue of whether or not Mr. Potter's opinions were new or not, is the fact that he said he never received any of the damage documents, none, not a single page, until trial. He never received a page of Casper's damage documents until trial. And that's not because we didn't give them to him. He said, my attorneys never gave me that information. They didn't give him that information because that was never to be his opinion. It was never going to be his opinion to say, you know what, Casper's damages are, they're out the door. They're They're too much here. They shouldn't have done this work. They shouldn't have done that. No. Their position until they settled with their subcontractors to push all of those damages back onto the subcontractors. In fact, their primary damage witness would have been our damage witness at trial had they not settled with those subcontractors. They would have simply said, you heard Mr. Potratz talk about all these damages, $1 million. We agree, because they did, all the way up until they settled with them. Those damages should go to these subcontractors, not to us. The other one point I would like to make, too, on the prejudgment interest, I mean, if we look at the purpose of prejudgment interest, which is to compensate the plaintiff for the loss of use of his money, that's equally applicable here. In this case, my client lost the use of his money, nearly $5 million for all of those years. Mr. Akers got that benefit to not provide him with the proper amount of pre-judgment and post-judgment interest is not a windfall for him by any means. In fact, failing to award the post-judgment interest on the judgment that contains an element of pre-judgment interest wrongfully decreases the present value of that judgment. The last thing I would say on the post-judgment interest, I would request that the court look at footnote 3 on tri-state refining. That's a classic example of compounding interest, and that didn't happen here. I respectfully request the court not to disturb the jury verdict in this matter and to affirm the trial court in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Erlinson. Mr. Peterson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Mr. Erlinson just claimed that Casper is out $5 million and lost the use of its money. So that's a policy reason to give them prejudgment interest. They paid for a hotel and at a fully operational hotel from day one. Jim Keeler, the owner of Casper Lodging, admitted that they never lost a single room. They lost absolutely no revenue, not one penny of lost profit. They got what they paid for, and they had the full use of that hotel. In particular with Merle Potter's exclusion, again, our damages expert, Mr. Erlinson just said, we never challenged the line items of damages. We didn't have their line items of damages until after our expert disclosure and after Merle Potter was deposed. Additionally, the original damages binder were provided to us as a mediation exhibit. They were not disclosed publicly until it showed up as an exhibit on the exhibit list, and then during trial, their damages binder changed 3 or 4 times during the course of trial, and we kept substituting binders. I believe that is in the record as well. So the information wasn't available to Merle Potter to study and analyze until trial or right on the eve of trial. And this is really the difference in the approach. Nelson and Potter both had some new things to talk about. When we wanted to do it, we were straight with the court and said, this is new, Judge. We did say that Merle Potter would talk about damages, but he hasn't been able to give specific opinions, and here's why. And we explained why, because he didn't have the information. When the shoe was on the other foot, and it was the plaintiff's turn to try to get in this new information from Mr. Nelson, I believe the record's pretty clear that it was a mischaracterization of what was disclosed. There was a paragraph read where the word fastener shows up in it, and then Mr. Erlinson after that says, he talks about fastening pattern, Your Honor. That means nailing. Casper knew full well that Mr. Nelson had never talked about structural unsoundness of the building from day one. It was only unsound because of long-term water damage. And there's a dispute about whose responsibility that is. Is it Mr. Akers or is it Casper's failure to mitigate? But that opinion on the structural unsoundness of the building was absolutely new. Trent Nelson admitted it never came up in his report or either deposition because he was deposed 2 times. And again, the trial court's rationale on that, the trial court didn't have an appreciation at that point in time for the distinction between those 2 very different opinions. And again, we believe that point was driven home in closing argument when Mr. Hofer stated, Mr. Nelson identified the codes and other applicable standards that were breached on the opening day. That's what was said. He didn't use the word nailing. He knew full well he couldn't do that. And what codes were breached on the opening day, according to Mr. Nelson? There was an issue with one tie-down among hundreds of tie-downs that was missing that needed to be put there. And there's some dirt that was too high against the foundation, which technically is a violation of the code. The grand total to correct those things is, I believe, less than $10,000. Was Mr. Hofer really reminding the jury of something that was pennies compared to the overall amount of the claim? We believe this was in the jury's mind the entire time, and they turned their ears off when they heard extensive testimony about this building being a code violation, being at risk of blowing over, being a nuisance, and needing to be basically, it was a code violation and structurally unsound from day one. That's not something that a jury can forget. It's too powerful, and it guts our mitigation defense.
Could you say a word or two about the Gettysburg case?
I can, Your Honor. There, the track was turned over, and the contract was performed as breach, but the track was turned over in, I believe, September of 2002. Interest was awarded from July of 2004. So there was about 2 years during which interest was not awarded.
And that was the date that the expert determined the track was defective, the 04 date?
I believe that is correct. And notably, what's important in that case and different in this case is the track wasn't usable. I mean, they didn't make repairs, but they couldn't use the track. So there was a loss immediately. In this case, the hotel was fully used for 6 years. There was no loss of use, no loss of income, like there was in the Gettysburg case. We believe that, first of all, the trial court did not make a determination of when damages occurred. If you read the court's rationale and opinion, the court just simply concluded, look, I think I've got to go from the date of breach, the date the hotel opened. The court didn't say, I think that's when damages occurred or that's when the loss occurred. There was no finding on that. And additionally, as we set forth in our brief, there's a part of the statute, 21.1.13.1, that if a party is prevented by law or the act of the creditor from paying the debt, then interest doesn't run. Bob Akers was not notified of a problem for approximately 3 years. It was March of 2007 when he was notified, we've got water problems with the hotel, and they've been going on for 3 years. Why should Bob Akers be responsible for paying $250,000 of interest for 3 years when he was never given notice of a problem, there was no loss of use, and Casper hadn't spent any money doing any sort of repairs? That's unjust, and it's contrary to our prejudgment interest statute. We believe that this court certainly could make a determination on prejudgment interest, but our calculation we submitted to the trial court is $493,000 in prejudgment interest. That goes from the particular dates of an invoice. If there's an invoice that is just a month and a year, we gave the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt and made it from the first day of that month and assumed it was paid on the first day, even though invoices are never paid. I mean, they've got to be sent, and payment has to be sent back. But we gave the benefit of the doubt and calculated $493,000. That calculation was never disputed by the plaintiff. At a minimum, the prejudgment interest issue should be remanded for the court to make that factual determination and then calculate interest accordingly. I do want to touch on the contract terminology. Again, Mr. Erlandson noticeably struggled identifying anything in the original contract that is a breach. It just lays out the purpose and says, I'm going to sell it to you. Here's the conditions. If these aren't met, you don't have to buy Mr. Keeler or Casper. And it's Casper's responsibility to do its due diligence to whatever level it chooses before deciding to spend money. These are both sophisticated hotel owners. we have to go to the addendum to get to anything that's even in the discussion. And the addendum, the purpose of the addendum is because of the 1031 tax closing date, Casper had to buy this hotel before it was done. So the first part of the addendum escrows a lot of money to pay for completion of construction in case Bob Akers says, I'm going to take the money and run and not pay for construction. So that's the first issue. The second part is it states that Akers has a continuing obligation. So there isn't anything new that Bob Akers is promising. And it states that the continuing obligation to meet government requirements and Holiday Inn Express requirements. And the government requirements, the requirement of the government is it needs to pass a building inspection. It did. Even if there was, in fact, a tie down in a wall that wasn't up to code, the requirement is that it passes building inspection. That was indisputably done. And the requirement of Holiday Inn Express is they need to sign off on this project, which they did. There's no objective quality of construction standard in any of the documentation. Bob Akers didn't promise that. He didn't promise defect-free construction. That risk was allocated to Casper. And it took on that risk having conditions before it became obligated, and then Casper accepted the warranties and took on the responsibility of contacting contractors to have repairs made if that was needed.
You're saying that the UBC wasn't incorporated by that language?
It was not, Your Honor. And to the extent that it was, it would be part of the conditions precedent that it needs to be billed according to code. But that's not a promise by Bob Akers that that will be done. That's a condition that Casper says it's either met or it's not. And if it's not met, I'm going to require that it's met, or I'm not closing. Or I'm comfortable with it, I'm going to close anyway and waive the condition. But that's Casper's choice to make. It's a risk it accepted under this contract.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.